Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I would like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. So I'm going to just keep this short and sweet. We're all here to hear from the same person tonight. We're happy to have him back here at the store. Robert Crace is here for his newest book, Suspect, and I'm just going to turn it right on over to him so we can give him our undivided attention.
Thank you. Thank you. Beth, thank you. Man, there's a lot of you tonight. I'm going to have to sign really fast. Thanks for coming here to see me. Also, thank you. Thanks for coming here at Tattered Cover and supporting this bookstore. It's more important now than ever before to support locally owned independent bookstores. So I'm glad to do my part. I'm really glad you guys are here doing your part. Okay, I see some familiar faces. I assume most of you guys have read some of my work in the past. Here's the disclaimer. Suspect is not an Elvis and Joe book. I don't want to hear any whining. You know, when I announced that I was writing a book about a dog, my day began with whining. My day ended with whining. I've had it up to here with the whining. I'm glad you love Elvis and Joe. Learn to love a dog. You know, it's not just fans and readers. I have to tell you, you know, my last year's book, Taken, did extremely well. I have a brick by brick career, right? Monkey's Raincoat. When I started at the bottom of the publishing pool, you know, category paperback original fiction. No appearances at Tattered Cover, no promotion, no touring, no anything. You know, the publisher just grind out 8 or 10 titles a month, throw it all against the wall, and pray something stuck. And little by little, readers stuck, and they hand sold it. And booksellers and bookstores like Tattered Cover hand sold the book. The floor people, and it all culminated into something that you know, a really fairly large readership. And last year's book, Taken, which was an Elvis Cole and Joe Pike book, debuted at number one on the New York Times list and was my best-selling book. So, of course, I was ecstatic, as any sane person would be. And my publisher, Putnam, who I refer to as the world's greatest publishers because they do a great job with me, they were beside themselves. So in the days following that announcement, when we all knew, because they were getting the numbers from all their accounts, how well the book was doing. I'm still on tour, but now we have the conference call, right? I'm in the car, and they're all back in a room back there on a speakerphone, and they're telling me how, you know, what the great news is and how thrilled we all are. Everybody's high-fiving each other telephonically in the cars. And then, you know, as we're sharing this great enthusiasm, my editor says to me, "So, tell us what Elvis and Joe are going to be doing next year's book." And which was a reasonable question, right? To which I replied, "Oh, wait, I'm not going to write about Elvis and Joe next year. I want to write a book about a dog." And there's this long silence. Yeah, and then they started to laugh because they thought I was making a joke, and I said no. I have this great character, Maggie, who's a former, military working dog for the USMC, and she was in Afghanistan with her Marine handler, and she's just fabulous, and now she's an LAPD canine patrol dog, or like not quite but kinda, and I love her, and I love Scott James, who's going to be her police handler, and I want to write a story about them. And there's this another long pause, and I said, but you have the number one best-selling book in America, so a lot of people like Elvis and Joe. Doesn't it kind of make sense you'd write another Elvis and Joe? So now I'm losing. You know, I'm here on the phone, and my euphoria of moments ago is now I'm in a death spiral, and I'm trying to think, how can I get these people back on my side? You know, I mean, to get them in gear, because I am emotionally committed to writing this book. You know, Maggie's already my dog. No one's taken my dog away. So I think for a second, the cliched light bulb pops, and I said, hey, guys, you know what? Listen, you don't really understand. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, when I say I'm going to write a book about a dog, you're thinking it's going to be like Lassie. You know, like a cartoon dog. Like, Lassie, get the car keys! You know, and Lassie does it. No, I'm not talking about a cartoon dog. This isn't, you know, Turner and Hooch. You know, the dog's not going to talk. The dog's not like a person. Elvis and Joe are partners. Now, there's been 15 of those books, and the theme running through all those books, specific story aside, the theme, and I think what people love about those characters, is that they're all about friendship. They're about loyalty. They're about devotion and trust. I said, that's Scott and Maggie. So think about it this way. Scott is Elvis Cole. Maggie is Joe Pike in a fur coat. Right? Now, you know, and you can, like, see it, visualize it, and you'll see what I'm thinking. See? Like Joe protects Elvis, right? Maggie protects Scott. Joe would kill somebody like that, no questions asked, for Elvis, has many times. Well, Maggie certainly would too, right? Maggie doesn't say much. So she's kind of like Joe in that regard too. So now they're starting to get on board, and they're saying, yeah, okay, we see, it's still going to be a Robert Crace novel, only with these new characters. I said, yeah, just like that. So now suddenly everybody starts perking up. Few months pass. I'm writing away, and I am loving it, because I have to tell you, I haven't, all of my books, to me, are emotional experiences, and they're all about things that are important to me, else I wouldn't write them. Writing this book was the single most emotional and moving experience that I've ever had writing anything throughout my life. There were days on end where we're writing about the purity of Maggie's heart and the bonding between a human being and a dog, and how that relationship can grow and develop. I mean, I was crying like a baby writing through this thing. So I'm going to tell you officially now, I know some of you, because of the time, there's probably plenty of people here who have already read the book. And when we get to the Q&A part, be very careful what you ask. We don't want to give away anything. But I am so in love with writing this. I'm blubbering like a baby. And if you, when you read the book, if you don't cry at least 5 times through the course of this novel, you're a bad human being. Take that to heart. People are watching you.
I didn't get through the epilogue.
Don't. You're a good man. So now I'm like 3 months into the writing of it, and the phone rings, and it's them. Because I knew this call was coming, right? See, because they can't let things go. But they say, how's it going? I say, it's great. I tell them all that. I just told you how much I'm loving writing a book. And they say, that's terrific, because I tell you, we've been thinking here. We've been really squeezing our brains about what can we do to introduce booksellers and reviewers and people, you know, to seed the interest in Scott and Maggie and kind of introduce them to the notion that this isn't Elvis and Joe, but it's something else. And I said, what is it? Well, by that point, they had already read the prologue, because I had sent them the prologue. And in the prologue, it establishes Maggie, and what Maggie's favorite toy is a green tennis ball. You know, she likes, that's her plaything. That's what she likes to chase and all this other stuff. I don't know. Did you guys, Beth, where are you? Oh, you got some? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. They probably showed you the green balls. So they said, that's what they said. They said, we've got a great idea. We're going to make these green tennis balls, say Maggie, on them, and we're going to send them out. Here.
Okay. Why does it give it back?
She says, she hands it to me. She says, as long as you give it back. But see, it says, I noticed that when you walked in. You're the best dressed person here. It says Maggie, and on the back it says me, you know.
Thank you.
So they just, we got these, and I think it's a great idea. They're going to make these tennis balls. So I'm going, that's great. But here's what's coming. Here's what's really coming. They say, so you give any thought yet to what next year's book is going to be? Not being a moron, I say, going to be an Elvis and Cole novel. An Elvis and Joe novel. To which Neil Nyer, my editor, says, he says, he doesn't miss a beat. He says, that's great because we thought of a great giveaway to bring everybody back around after Suspect comes out to say, to make an announcement, you know, Elvis and Joe are back. And I said, cool, what's the giveaway for there too? We're going to give away Joe's balls. But I'm just as funny as Neil, so I immediately say, where are you going to find a set that big? Scott and Maggie, they are new characters. She's a dog. She is trained by the government at Lackland Air Force Base, which is where all military working dogs get their original training, as a dual-purpose patrol and explosive detection dog. When she's in Afghanistan with her Marine canine handler, a suicide bomber detonates himself, takes her handler, wounds her. Maggie, because she is a pack of two with her handler, covers his body in an effort to protect him, whereupon an Al-Qaeda sniper tries to kill her, shoots her twice. She survives that, but after healing, is discovered to suffer from the effects of PTSD. Which dogs can and do suffer? And the symptoms in canine PTSD are identical to the symptoms in a human being. Anxiety disorders, sleeplessness, withdrawal, exaggerated startle response, et cetera, et cetera. And the treatments are in the main fairly the same as for treatments with human sufferers of PTSD. The chemical medications given to alleviate some of those symptoms are the same. The same anti-anxiety meds, Ativan, Xanax, you know, that kind of, you know, the things that half you people are taking. Some of us more than others. And those things are all the same, except for one, and it's primary, for one big difference. When a human being suffers from PTSD, the primary way it's treated is talk therapy. You know, there's no, if you have PTSD, they don't just like, here's the PTSD pill, and they give it to you. They, you know, they treat the different symptoms, sleeplessness, you take sleeping pills, et cetera. But the underlying cause of the disorder is treated by talk therapy. That's why you no doubt have heard, you know, about and are familiar with, you know, like PTSD groups, discussion groups, therapy. Constantly, endlessly talking about the event is the only known way to try to dissipate the negative energy of the event, in hopes that over time, by dissipating the energy, the event loses some, you can't really take it all away, but loses some of its power. Dogs can't talk, so dogs can't get rid of it that way. Efforts are made by trainers at Lackland to retrain dogs, et cetera, to try. Well, I mean, clearly, the military's goal here is to return the dog to service so the dog can work. Sometimes that happens. When it doesn't happen, the dog's retired and is put up to be adopted, where appropriate, to be adopted by people who want to adopt them. That's what happens to Maggie. She's adopted by a family, but it turns out that they can't really keep her. So they donate her to the LAPD canine platoon. Police department canine units around the country get their dogs typically in two ways. They either buy them, and this is mostly how they get them, they buy them from specific breeders. Some of those breeders in the United States, most are in Europe, the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany. And the typical dogs that are bought for police work, police patrol dogs, are either German Shepherds or Belgian Malinois. If you don't know what a Belgian Malinois is, it looks like a German Shepherd, only it's smaller. And it has a different colored coat. They tend to be either fawn or brindle. They don't have that black and tan jacket that German Shepherds have. But most people, when they look at a Malinois, especially a fawn Malinois, can't tell the difference and think it's a German Shepherd. What's funny, I spent a lot of time with the LAPD canine platoon. They were terrific and helped me, answered all my questions, let me see them work with the dogs and all that other good stuff. When the dogs come from Europe, they're about 2 years old when they get here. And remember, they're coming from the Netherlands or Germany. So when they arrive and they've already been trained, they speak German. So the first time I went out to the canine training facility, I'm listening to the LAPD handlers working their dogs. And, you know, I mean, I know my hearing's going, so I'm like, you know, because it all sounds kind of funny when they're out in the field and they're kind of far away anyway, but I hear them shouting commands at their dogs. And I was standing with an assistant trainer, and I said, what did he just say? And the guy laughed. He said, he's speaking Dutch. You know, because wherever the origin country is, of course, it's easier to teach the handler how to give commands in a foreign language than it is to retrain the dog to speak English. Except for the dogs they get from like the Czech Republic, because the language there, the words, the command words are so long and multisyllabic that Americans can't pronounce them anyway. In those cases, they make up words and they just reteach the dog in a different shorthand language. It's wild. That's who Maggie is. She's donated to the LAPD canine platoon. She's not purchased. She's donated. Only the chief trainer, who is vested with the power to assess each dog that comes in, whether it's bought or donated, he discovers her PTSD and doesn't want her. He's getting ready to send her back when Scott James makes the scene. When Scott makes the scene, Scott's coming off a very similar background. Scott has never had a dog, doesn't even like dogs, never wanted to be a canine handler. Scott wanted to be a SWAT officer. He was a hot young patrol cop. He was making all the right moves to check off all the boxes necessary to apply for and be selected to the elite SWAT team. Only one night when he and his uniform partner Stephanie are rolling code 7 and trying to find some ramen at 3 in the morning, they stumble upon 5 men with automatic weapons who then proceed to try to kill them. Stephanie is killed. Scott's shot up bad. But the worst part is that when all the shooting's going on and Scott is trying to get back to their black and white so he can get his shotgun, is when Stephanie dies. And Scott knows that Stephanie dies believing he's running away. And his guilt from that has crushed him. So 9 months later, after the fact, Scott is suffering from PTSD, is haunted by Stephanie's dying belief that he left her. When he gets a call from the chief trainer, Dominic Leland, who tells him, the new dogs we bought are in, come get your dog. Scott's going to be assigned his first dog. So he reports to the LAPD training kennel. When he's parking, he's going in and he sees an assistant trainer named Mace Styrick working a German Shepherd Scott's never seen around a facility before. But he's got things on his mind. He goes into Leland. Leland takes him into the training kennel to get his new dog. I'm going to read you that scene. This is where they meet for the first time. That's not my book. This is my book. Leland stopped between the second and third runs where the two new dogs were waiting. There was skinny Belgian Malinois. Both dogs stood when Leland entered, and the near dog barked twice. Leland beamed as if they were his children. "Aren't these boys gorgeous? Look at these boys. They are handsome young men." The Barker barked again, and both furiously wagged their tails. Scott knew both dogs had arrived fully trained by the breeder, in accordance with written guidelines supplied by the canine platoon. This meant Leland, who traveled to breeders all over the world in search of the best available dogs. Leland had spent the past 3 days personally running the dogs through their paces, evaluating their fitness and learning each dog's personality and peculiarities. Not every dog sent to the canine platoon measured up to Leland's standards. He down-checked those who did not and returned them to their breeder. Leland glanced at the dog in the second run. "Now this one here is Gutman. Why on earth those fools named him Gutman, I do not know, but that's his name." Purchase dogs were usually around 2 years old when they arrived, so they had already been named. Donated dogs were often a year or two older. "And this here is Quarlo." Gutman barked again and went up on his hind legs, trying to lick Leland through the gate. Leland said, "Gutman's kind of high-strung, so I'm going to put him with another handler. Quarlo is smart as a whip. He's got a good head on his shoulders and is easy to work with, so I think you and Mr. Quarlo here are going to make a fine match." Scott interpreted "easy to work with" and "smart as a whip" as Leland's way of saying the other dog was too much for Scott to handle. The better handlers were getting the more difficult dogs. Scott was the class moron. Scott heard the door open at the far end of the kennel and saw Mace Styrick come in with the German Shepherd. He put the Shepherd into a run, dragged out a large canine crate, and closed the Shepherd's gate. Scott studied Quarlo. He was a beautiful dog with a dark fawn body, black face, and upright black ears. His eyes were warm and intelligent. His steady demeanor was obvious. Where Gutman frittered and fidgeted, Quarlo stood utterly calm. Leland was probably right. This would be the easiest dog for Scott. Scott glanced at Leland, but Leland wasn't looking at him. Leland was smiling at the dog. Scott said, "I'll work harder. I'll work as hard as it takes." Leland studied Scott for a moment. The only time Scott recalled Leland not scowling was when he looked at the dogs, but now he seemed thoughtful. He touched the leash clipped to his belt. "This isn't steel and nylon. It's a nerve, son. You clip one end to you, you clip the other to this animal. It ain't for dragging him down the street to take a pee. You feel him through this nerve, and he feels you. And what flows through here flows both ways. Anxiety, fear, discipline, approval. Right through this nerve, without you and your dog ever having to look at each other, without you ever having to say a word. He can feel it, and you can feel it too." Leland let go of his leash and looked back at Quarlo. "You're going to work hard, all right. I know you're a worker. But there's things work can't build. I watched you out here for 8 weeks, and you did everything I asked you to do. But I never saw anything flow through your leash. You understand what I'm saying? I'll work harder." Scott was trying to figure out what else to say when another handler opened the door behind him and asked Leland to check his dog's foot. The handler looked worried. Leland told Scott he would be right back and hurried away, scowling. Scott stared at Quarlo for several seconds, then walked to the other end of the kennel where Mace was now looking hosing out the crate. Scott said, "Hey." Mace said, "Hey, watch you don't get splashed." The Shepherd was lying with her head between her paws on a padded mat at the back of the run. She was a classic black and tan German Shepherd with a black muzzle giving way to light brown cheeks and mask, a black blaze on the top of her head, and enormous black ears. Her eyebrows bunched as she looked from Scott to Mace and back again. No other part of her moved. A hard rubber toy lay untouched on the newspaper, as did a leather chew and a fresh bowl of water. A name was written on the side of the crate. Scott cocked his head sideways to read it. Maggie. Scott guessed she had to go 80 or 85 pounds, a lot bigger than a Balinois. She was big through the chest and hips the way shepherds were, but it was the hairless gray lines on her hindquarters that drew him. He squeezed past the crate for a better view and watched her eyes follow him. This Maggie? Yeah. She ours? Nah, donation dog. Family down Oceanside thought we could use her, but Leland's sending her back. Scott studied the pale lines and decided they were scars. What happened to her? Mace put aside the hose and joined Scott at the gate. Wounded in Afghanistan. The scars there from the surgeries. No shit, a military working dog? U.S. Marine, this girl. She healed up okay, but Leland says she's unfit. What kind of work did she do? Dual purpose. Patrol and explosives detection. Scott knew almost nothing about military working dogs, except that the training they received was specialized and excellent. Bomb getter? Nah, her handler was blown up by one of those suicide nuts. The dog here stayed with him, and some asshole sniper tried to kill her. No shit. For real, shot her twice. Parked herself on her boy and wouldn't leave. Trying to protect him, I guess. Wouldn't even let other Marines get near him. Scott stared at the German Shepherd, but Mace and the kennel faded, and he heard the gunfire that night when Stephanie died, the automatic rifle churning its thunder, the chorus of pistols snapping like whips. Then Maggie's brown eyes met his, and he was back in the kennel again. Scott bit the inside of his mouth and cleared his throat before speaking. She didn't leave her partner. That's the story. Scott noted how she watched them. Her nose worked constantly, sucking in their smells. Even though she had not moved from her prone position, Scott knew she was focused totally on them. If she healed up okay, what's Leland's problem? Well, she's bad with noise, for one. And see how she lays back there all kind of timid? Leland thinks she's got a stress disorder. Dogs get the PTSD just like people. Scott felt himself flush and opened the gate to hide his irritation. He wondered if Mace and the other handlers spoke about him like this behind his back. Scott said, "Hey, Maggie, how's it going?" Maggie lay on her belly with her ears folded back, which was a sign of submission. But she stared directly into his eyes, which possibly indicated aggression. Scott slowly approached her. She watched as he came, but her ears stayed down and she issued no warning growl. He held the back of his hand toward her. "You a good girl, Maggie?" "I'm Scott. I'm a police officer, so don't give me any trouble, okay?" Scott squatted a couple of feet from her and watched her nose work. "Can I pet you, Maggie? How about I pet you?" He moved his hand slowly closer and was 6 inches from her head when she bit him. She moved insanely fast, snarling and snapping, and caught the top of his hand as he jerked to his feet. May shouted and charged into the run. "Jesus, she get you?" Maggie quit her attack as quickly as she bit him and once more lay on her belly. Scott had jumped back and now stood 3 feet away. "Dude, you're bleeding. Let me see. She get you deep?" Scott pressed his handkerchief over the cut. "Nah, it's nothing. Forget it." He watched Maggie's eyes move from him to Mace and back, as if she had to watch them both because either might attack her. Scott made his voice soothing. "You got hurt bad, big girl." "Yes, you did." But then to himself he said, "But I'll bet I've been shot more times than you." He squatted again and held out his hand, letting her smell his blood. This time, she let him touch her. He spread his fingers through the soft fur between her ears, then slowly stood and stepped away. She stayed on her belly, watching him, as he and Mace backed out of her run. Mace said, "You see, that's why she's going back. Leland says they get fucked up like this with the PTSD, they're never right again." "Leland said that?" "Voice of God." Scott left Mace washing out Maggie's crate and walked back through the offices and outside where he found Leland. Leland said, "Well now, you and Corlo ready to get to work?" "I want the German Shepherd." "Well, you can't have the Shepherd. She's going back." "Maggie, let me work with her. Give me 2 weeks." "Well, that dog's no good. She's going back." "Give me 2 weeks to change her mind." Leland scowled, then grew thoughtful again and fingered his leash. "Okay, 2 weeks. You got her." Scott followed Leland back inside to get his new dog. That's where they meet. And it is a book about, you know, Robert Cray's crime writer. Yes, there's a detective work. Yeah, there's lots of shooting in it. It is a love story. It is about Scott and Maggie, how they have to learn to trust, how they have to find a way to become a team, because they are suspect. No one thinks they should be there. No one believes they can do the job. And if they can't help each other, then they never will. I'm going to read you five true stories, and then we'll take some Q&A. This, what? Before the Q&A or no more than? See, I'm on a time constraint. So okay, got it. Never mind. I'm not going to read you these true stories. We'll just go. Okay, two. I'll read you two. Right. These are true. Hang on. We'll have a riot. While on patrol in Fallujah, Iraq, Marine K-9 handler Corporal Dustin Lee and his explosive detection dog Lex, a German Shepherd, were targeted by rocket-propelled grenades. Corporal Lee was instantly killed. Though severely wounded, Lex dragged himself to Lee's body and refused to leave his handler until they were physically separated by other Marines. Lex was retired due to his injuries and was adopted by Corporal Lee's family. That was the first time in Marine Corps history that a military working dog was allowed to be adopted by a fallen handler's family. Army K-9 handler Corporal Corey Weens and his specialized search dog Cooper, a Labrador retriever, were killed in action together by an IED in Iraq. Cooper was Corporal Weens' first military working dog. This was their first deployment. Corporal Weens was Cooper's first handler. During their training and certification together, in letters home to his family, Corporal Weens said he loved and cared for Cooper so much he thought of Cooper as his son. After they were killed, at the corporal's parents' request, the cremated remains of their son and his dog were buried together. Sergeant Adam Kahn, USMC, and his dual-purpose explosive detection dog, Bruno, were working crowd control surrounded by 1,000 people outside an Iraqi police recruiting station. When Bruno alerted to the scent of explosives, Sergeant Kahn confronted the suspect, who detonated the 40 pounds of high explosives and ball bearings strapped to his body. Sergeant Kahn, who had stepped between his dog and the terrorist, took the full force of the blast and was instantly killed. Bruno, though wounded, scrambled to his feet and stood over Kahn's body, snapping and snarling at the panic, fleeing, crushing crowd. He would let no one near Kahn's body. It took the Marines had to muzzle Bruno before they could lead him away. It isn't just military working dogs and military dog handlers. Missouri State Trooper Fred Guthrie and his canine partner Reed, German Shepherd, were patrolling a flooded area for people in distress when Guthrie failed to respond to radio calls. When officers went searching for Reed, he was found. Reed was found drowned in water approximately 100 yards from Guthrie's parked vehicle. They didn't find Guthrie's body until 5 months later when the waters receded. His body was found beneath a brush pile only a few yards from where Reed's body had been found. No one knows why they entered the water, though Guthrie had received the Missouri State Medal of Valor 4 years earlier for saving a woman from drowning. Again, there were no witnesses to what happened that day, but it is surmised that for reasons unknown, Guthrie entered the water and got into trouble and was drowning. Reed, his dog, then took it upon himself to enter the water in an attempt to save his handler. They both drowned. At the funeral service for Guthrie and his dog, fellow canine officers carried baskets filled with hundreds of yellow tennis balls into the church. This was because Trooper Guthrie had used tennis balls to train Reed. The tennis balls were his favorite toy. These are all true. If you spent 20 minutes on the internet, you'd find 200 stories just like this. The depth of loyalty and devotion between a human being and their dog is moved me to my core, and it's what motivated me to create Maggie and Scott and write this book. Like I said, it's a love story. It's a story that I hope celebrates that kind of devotion and loyalty, and why so many of us love dogs and have dogs in our lives. They heal us and they comfort us, and in many ways, even another human being can't, they complete us. So that's Suspect. And now we have a few brief minutes for questions and answers before I'll start signing books. So who's going to go first? Yes.
Do you have dogs?
I actually have no dogs. I have cats. I love them. They're cats. But quickly I'll answer. The reason I have no dogs is what led me to write this book. I always had dogs, and I had a dog ever since I was a boy. And my most recent dog was a big Akita that was mine from when he was 3 days old before his eyes opened. And I had him for 12 years, and he died, and he was my guy. And I was never able to replace him. Every time the notion or it was suggested to me, why don't you get another dog, I felt terribly disloyal. And it felt in guilty, the notion that I could, quote-unquote, replace him. That's not the proper word, but that's the way I thought of it. And it seemed to me that he was so devoted and loyal to me that should flow, as Leland says, both ways. And the first couple of years after he passed away, I just wrote off my feelings as, well, you know, I'm in mourning and all this. But through the years, it would occasionally occur, you know, someone would say, hey, how about getting another dog? And I knew dogs, friends of mine have dogs. Often those friends' dogs like me better than them. I'm a dog guy. And every time I thought about getting a new dog, I was just hit by this powerful feeling of disloyalty to my dog. Then a couple of years later, now, by the way, again, this dog died over 15 years ago, now almost 16 years. So a couple of years ago, I really was liking this German Shepherd, and a friend of mine has, and we play all a lot. I dog sit for them. You know, I mean, it's great because I love the dog. But maybe I'll get one of my own. And then I had the same feelings. I thought to myself, wait a minute, it's been like a dozen years now. Are you crazy? So when I started research, it wasn't to find a book. I actually started reading about the human-dog bond and dogs and all of this stuff and people and dogs' perception and devotion and loyalty and why they're that way, et cetera. Never thinking I'd get a book out of it. I was just trying to find out what was wrong with me. But it led to the world of dogs and how dogs think, how they perceive, why dogs relate to us the way they do, why we relate to them the way we do. And that led to the whole notion that led to police canine officers and their dogs and military working dogs and military handlers, because there is no tighter union, I think, than between a military working dog and his handler or her handler when they are downrange and deployed. Now, we have dogs, we love them. We know our dogs are devoted to us and all this great stuff, and it's true. But no one lives as close with their dog as a military canine handler and his bomb sniffer when they're over there in the desert, because they live together 24/7. And for the dog, the way the job works, you know, they're attached to a squad or a platoon or a company on an as-needed basis for a 2 or 3 or 4 day mission or whatever it is, going to clear 5 miles of road looking for IEDs, and they're out there and they do that, going to clear a few buildings out there and they do that. Then they get another job with a different company or a different platoon or a different squad. So for the dog, only one human face is constant. Everybody else just passing through. The one constant human in a dog's life is its handler. And while they are out in the field, they eat together because, I mean, the guys weren't like friends with the dog. You really want to have some 90-pound German Shepherd staring at your MRE when you're sitting there eating it? No, no, you don't. They eat together. They go off by themselves. They eat together. They sleep together. It gets cold in the desert. So the handler and the dog, you know, they huddle up in a sleeping bag together, man, because they're trying to stay warm. They become a pack of two, and it yields the kind of devotion of those real stories that I told you. And it all came about because I had, you know, emotional trouble dealing with the loss of my dog and trying to see my way clear to getting a new dog. So now I still have cats, but I think I'm ready and we get a new dog after this is all over. Yes?
It seemed to me that L.A. Requiem was the end of that series. And then when you did take up Elvis and Joe again, the style is very different than the first books were written in. Did you go through some kind of a process of deliberately wanting to pare down your writing, or how did that happen?
She's asking me if there was a change in my writing style and in the books, beginning with L.A. Requiem, and how and why did that happen? Yes, there is. And why it happened is because I wanted a broader canvas to tell the stories I want to tell and explore the characters the way I wanted to explore them. My books, the 7 books I wrote prior to L.A. Requiem, were mostly told in the classic Raymond Chandler style of a private American private detective novel. You know, all first-person point of view of the narrator, who was then Elvis Cole. Beginning with L.A. Requiem, I went multi-character, multi-viewpoint, and parallel plot lines, and the books became much more complex. I began using third-person for some of the characters. I still maintain the first-person for Elvis's character. But it was by design, simply because I wanted to tell bigger, richer stories. So that's why I've been, all the books since then have all been written in my new form. I have to plug it. So I thank all of you for coming out tonight. I'm going to sign some books now, but really thanks a lot. And thanks for supporting this store.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.